Welcome, the learner. You're here because, well, you want to get up to speed quickly, especially starting out in cognitive science.
Right, it's a big field.
It is. So think of this as a focused session just for you, like a CogSci 101 student needing to cut through the noise. We've got your intro materials, and the mission today is to unpack how the brain actually works.
Yeah, the fundamentals, connecting the dots, from
Yeah.
neurons all the way up to the big picture.
Exactly. We want those aha moments without the information overload. Sound good.
Sounds like a plan. We want to build that solid framework for you, not just facts, but how it all fits together, which is pretty crucial for cognitive science.
Okay, let's dive in. So, the brain, it's a physical thing, right? Not just some abstract idea. And how we've understood this physical thing, it's changed a lot.
Oh, absolutely. And it's fascinating how it almost always mirrors, well, whatever the cutting-edge technology of the time was.
You mean like the examples in the source, the Greek catapults?
Yeah, exactly. Catapults for forces, so the mind had forces.
Hmm.
Then Leibniz's mill, intricate clockwork, so the brain was like clockwork.
Babbage's loom, predicting information processing.
Right. And Freud used hydraulics, Sherrington the telephone exchange.
And now it's neural networks and neuromorphic systems.
Precisely. It shows how we grasp the abstract using tangible metaphors from our world. It's a good reminder to be a bit critical of our current models, too. They're powerful, but they're still metaphors.
That makes sense. We need something concrete. Which brings us to this term, neuronaki. It's mentioned as a broader term than just neurobiology, especially in places like Poland.
Yeah, that's a good point for a cognitive science student. Neurobiology sounds purely biological, right?
Yeah.
But neuronaki, or neurosciences, really captures the interdisciplinary nature.
So it's not just biology.
Not at all. It's chemistry, physics, computer science, psychology, medicine. They all feed into it. That's the world you're stepping into with cognitive science.
And the sheer scale is mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Studying stuff happening in nanoseconds up to years. And from nanometers to, well, the whole brain.
Exactly. And then you have all these branches: neuroanatomy, cellular, molecular, developmental, clinical, systems, cognitive.
Neuroscience, that sounds pretty central for us. Neurolinguistics is in there too.
Yep, language and the brain. Then you've got computational neuroscience, neuroengineering, neuroimaging, neuroinformatics.
Yeah.
The list goes on.
Wow, each one is like a different lens to view the brain.
That's the idea. And cognitive science borrows heavily from many of these, like neuroimaging to see what's happening or computational models to simulate it. You don't need to memorize the list now, but just appreciate the breadth.
Yeah, it's huge. And the source mentioned the Society for Neuroscience conference, tens of thousands of
It's
researchers.
massive. The field is exploding, which is exciting, but
There's a but.
well, with that explosion comes the risk of oversimplification. The sources mention neuromyths popping up.
Ah, right. Like in management or education, slack neuro on something and it sounds scientific.
Exactly. So, critical thinking is key. Just because it says neuro doesn't automatically make it solid science. Be skeptical. Ask for the evidence.
Good advice. Okay, so staying critical. The next big theme is evolution. The brain didn't just appear, it evolved.
Fundamentally, it's shaped by the same principles as everything else in biology. Darwin's struggle for existence. Sure, competition is part of it.
But cooperation too, right? Kropotkin's idea.
Yes, absolutely. Especially for social behaviors. Population genetics helps us understand how those evolve.
And then there's the genes eye view, Hamilton's idea, that genes are kind of driving things, even seemingly selfless acts, if it helps related genes survive.
Right, that concept of kin selection helps explain altruism from an evolutionary perspective. It's a
Yeah.
powerful framework.
And Maturana's autopoietic systems,
Yeah.
self-producing, self-maintaining, how does that relate?
Maturana linked that idea of self-maintenance directly to cognition. He saw cognition very broadly, basically. Any action a system takes that leads to changes within itself over time. It's not just reacting to the world, but actively maintaining its way of being in the world.
So that connects to neuroplasticity, the
Yeah.
brain changing itself.
Exactly. The system modifies itself through its interactions. Neuroplasticity is the mechanism for that at the neural level.
Got it. And the sources also bring up sexual reproduction, shuffling the genetic deck, basically.
Yeah, recombination. It speeds up adaptation, helps resist diseases. It's related to the Red Queen hypothesis.
You have to keep running just to stay in the same place,
Yeah,
evolutionarily speaking.
that's the idea. Constant adaptation is needed just to keep up with parasites, predators, and environmental changes. Sexual reproduction provides the variation fuel for that.
And those xenobots, Biological robots from frog cells. That sounds wild.
It is. It shows how biological components can self-organize in totally unexpected ways.
Yeah.
Gives us new ideas about development, maybe even robotics.
Now, a key evolutionary point. It builds on what's already there, right?
Mm.
No starting from scratch.
Definitely not. Evolution is a tinkerer, not an engineer with a blank sheet. That's why we see conserved structures and molecules across different species. Similar genes, proteins, neuron structures, signaling molecules.
So as life got more complex, the nervous system had to keep up.
Yeah.
From basic regulation to
reacting quickly, developing specialized senses, planning, memory, figuring out cause and effect. Each step added complexity to meet new challenges.
And neuroplasticity is key throughout, the ability to change.
Absolutely essential.
Mm-hmm.
Adapting to the environment requires rapid changes in the brain. Learning is neuroplasticity in action.
Okay, so that's the evolutionary backdrop. Now the basic structures, how it's all put together. Even simple animals had some coordination.
Right, think of a jellyfish. No central brain, just a nerve net. Axons transmitting electrical impulses to coordinate movement. Simple, but effective for its needs.
Then came cephalization, getting ahead.
Concentrating nerve tissue and senses at one end. And then encephalization, where ganglia clusters of neurons became more specialized, led to the huge variety of brains we see.
And maybe a link between bigger brains and social cooperation.
It's a plausible hypothesis. Managing complex social relationships requires significant cognitive horsepower, which could drive brain evolution.
So in complex systems like ours, it's modular, different subsystems working together.
Yeah, like departments in a company. You've got systems for homeostasis, keeping the internal environment stable. Systems for analyzing senses, controlling muscles, managing sleep cycles, reproduction.
Makes sense. Specialization.
Efficiency. And at the top level, you have the central nervous system, CNS, brain and spinal cord. That's the command center.
Interacting with the peripheral nervous system, PNS?
Right. The PNS connects the CNS to everything else, and it has two main parts.
The somatic system, the stuff we consciously control, like moving muscles and feeling things.
Exactly. Voluntary control, sensory input. And the other part is the autonomic nervous system, ANS.
The automatic stuff, heartbeat, digestion, breathing.
Right. Involuntary functions.
Yeah.
Keeping the lights on behind the scenes.
And the ANS has two branches, sympathetic and parasympathetic.
Yep. Often working in opposition. Sympathetic is the fight or flight system, gets you revved up.
Accelerator.
Good analogy.
Yeah.
And the parasympathetic is rest and digest.
The break. So they balance each other out to maintain homeostasis?
Precisely. It's a dynamic balancing act.
But there's another nervous system, the enteric nervous system, the gut brain.
Yeah. It's huge. More neurons than the spinal cord.
Yeah.
Lines the digestive tract.
Yeah.
It does more than just digestion, though.
Mood, motivation, thinking.
Increasingly, yes.
Yeah.
There's this constant conversation happening along the gut-brain axis. Even the microbes in your gut, the microbiome, seem to influence brain function and mood. It's a really hot area of research.
Wow. Okay, so nerves themselves, bundles of axons, like cables.
Pretty much. And many axons have a myelin sheath, like insulation, to speed up the signal.
And some bring info in sensory, and some send commands out motor.
Correct. Sensories are afferent, arriving at the CNS. Motors efferent, exiting the CNS. And don't forget the cranial nerves, connecting directly to the brainstem for head and neck functions.
And even the heart has neurons, neurocardiology.
Yeah, small clusters, helps regulate the heartbeat locally, responds to stress. It's not just a pump, it has its own little piece of the nervous system. Shows how integrated it all is.
Okay, structure and evolution, check. Now numbers. The brain as an information processor starts with atoms. We're mostly water.
Seems basic, but yeah, mostly hydrogen and oxygen by atom count. And water itself is an example of emergence. Its properties are totally different from hydrogen and oxygen gas. Simple components, complex results.
So brain weight, about 1,375 grams for an adult. But size doesn't equal intelligence?
Not directly, no. Einstein's brain wasn't unusually large. Anatole France's was small. Turgenev's was huge. It's more about the connections, the organization, the complexity, not just raw size.
What about the encephalization quotient? Brain to body mass ratio.
It's a way to compare across species, but it has limits. Marmosets actually have a higher EQ than humans. So total brain size and complexity, especially cortex, seem more relevant for intelligence, particularly in primates.
But even though it's only 2% of our body mass, it uses tons of energy.
A huge amount. Around 20% of our oxygen, 25% of our glucose, runs at about 20-25 watts constantly.
Where does all that energy go?
A lot goes into synaptic activity, neurotransmitter release, and recycling. maintaining ion gradients for signaling, especially at excitatory synapses run by glutamate receptors. Generating action potentials also costs energy. Interestingly, inhibitory neurons seem a bit more energy efficient.
And humans use proportionally more than other animals.
Yes, relative to size, the human brain is exceptionally energy hungry.
And we fuel this by metabolizing food, like oxidation.
Basically, yeah. Sure. It's controlled combustion, converting food into energy. And that surprising fact about weight loss.
Most of it leaves the CO2 when we breathe out and water.
That's right. The carbon atoms from fat are exhaled as carbon dioxide. It's basic chemistry, but kind of counterintuitive.
Okay, brain states, the number is practically infinite.
Theoretically, yes. The number of possible patterns of neural activity is astronomical. Far more potential brain states than distinguishable mental states we experience, which hints at the complexity.
But classifying mental states is hard itself.
Very hard. It's subjective, fuzzy. Signal detection theory helps us think about how the brain or a person distinguishes signals from noise, which relates to how we report our own states.
Neuron numbers. We said 86 billion for humans, roughly.
That's the current estimate. Huge range across species. From C. elegans with 302 to elephants with over 250 billion. But a lot of ours, about 16 billion, are in the cortex.
In the cortex surface area, large, but maybe not the largest.
Dolphins and elephants have larger cortical surfaces, yeah. But the organization matters. The relative size of our lobes, especially the frontal lobe, and specific areas like BA10.
Area 10, for planning, decision-making.
Right, executive functions. It's particularly large and has a unique structure in primates, especially humans. Lots of connections.
Then synapses. Trillions. Hundreds of trillions.
Massive numbers. And interesting how it peaks in childhood, then gets pruned back, like refining the network.
So when we look at an MRI scan,
you're seeing the summed activity of millions, maybe billions of neurons and synapses within each little cube, each voxel. It's a macroscopic view.
And glial cells. Not 10 times more than neurons anymore.
Nope. That seems to be a myth. The ratio is closer to 1-to-1 now. And we know glia to do way more than just support neurons. They're active players in signaling.
And one synapse doesn't do much on its own.
Generally, no. A single synaptic input causes only a tiny change in the next neuron's voltage. You need many inputs arriving close together in time and space to sum up and reach the threshold to fire an action potential. It allows for integration of information.
White matter, the myelinated cables for speed.
Crucial for rapid communication between distant brain areas. And its structure changes across the lifespan, reflecting development and aging.
Memory capacity. Estimates are huge, petabits. But conscious processing is slow, kilobit second.
That difference is striking, isn't it? Shows how much processing happens beneath the surface of our awareness. Consciousness is just the tip of the iceberg.
And computational power. Petaflops, maybe, but it's not like a computer.
Not really. The architecture is fundamentally different. Asynchronous, distributed processing, memory interwoven with processing. Memory means something different in biology versus computer science.
But reaction times can be super fast, 100 milliseconds.
Yeah, for some tasks. Suggests highly efficient, maybe few-step pathways for critical responses.
And technology is catching up. Neuromorphic chips.
IBM True North, Intel OEE Cerebras. They're trying to mimic brain architecture. Getting impressive, but still.
Still can't beat a human at everything. Like, go.
Right. The brain's architecture has unique strengths, especially for learning, adaptation, and dealing with ambiguity. Tasks that still challenge even massive supercomputers.
And that contrast. Stable genes, exploding learned information.
Over the last million years, yeah. Highlights the massive role of culture and learning in shaping who we are.
And the brain needs structure. Random connections would be too big.
Physically impossible at that scale.
Yeah.
Genes provide a blueprint, setting up the basic organization, but they can't specify every single connection out of trillions. Experience fine-tunes the wiring.
Okay. Structure, numbers, processing. Now, homeostasis and the brainstem, the survival core.
Absolutely fundamental. The oldest part, managing the basics.
The source lists essentials. Internal state info, homeostasis, ANS, hypothalamus, inputs, outputs, senses, muscles, CNS, central relay, brainstem, thalamus, spatial memory, hippocampus, emotional memory reactions, limbic system, amygdala, and conscious stuff, cortex, layered, like you said.
A good functional breakdown. The brainstem is the bedrock.
Homeostasis is keeping things stable, temp, chemicals, hormones. And allostasis is anticipating change, like circadian rhythms.
Exactly. Homeostasis is reactive stability. Allostasis is predictive stability. Maintaining balance by adjusting before things go too far off kilter.
We feel some drives consciously. Hunger, thirst, pain, motivates action.
Right. But a lot is unconscious regulation too, like craving salt when your body needs it, even if you don't consciously know why.
And how fast we return to balance matters. The scurvy example shows we aren't aware of all needs, especially long-term ones.
Evolution prioritized immediate threats. Slow deficiencies like scurvy weren't the most pressing selective pressures compared to, say, escaping a predator.
The brainstem itself, the R-complex, or reptilian brain, very old.
Yes, found in all vertebrates, handles basic survival functions, influences higher areas through direct pathways and by releasing neuromodulators.
It's a conduit for nerve tracks, controlling muscles.
Major pathway for motor commands going down and sensory info coming up. Damage often causes paralysis because those tracks are packed so tightly. Controls most muscles, except, interestingly, vertical eye movements.
And there are specific versus non-specific pathways.
Specific pathways carry distinct sensory info, like vision or touch, rapidly up to the cortex via the thalamus. Non-specific pathways, mainly from the reticular formation.
Activate the whole cortex. Make it ready.
Kind of prime it, yeah. Increase arousal and readiness to process incoming information. Acetylcholine helps with that desynchronization needed for focused processing.
Main brain stem parts, medulla, pons, midbrain, plus the diencephalon, thalamus, pineal, pituitary.
That covers the major divisions.
Medulla. Breathing, blood pressure, heart rate. Reflexes like sucking, swallowing, vomiting, sneezing, coughing. Wow.
It's the life support center. Even things like the olive nuclei helping locate sounds. Dysfunction here is serious sleep apnea, SIDS link. Reflexes like sneezing are protective, coordinated by specific medullary nuclei.
Pons connects to the cerebellum, motor control relay.
Yes, crucial bridge for motor signals between cerebrum and cerebellum. Damage can cause motor issues, weird emotional responses like involuntary laughing, crying, eye movement problems.
Sources admit there's more to homeostasis, thermoregulation, feedback loops. But the big picture is...
it's a whole system effort. Chemical, immune, microbiota, ANS, CNS, all interacting to maintain stability. And this isn't just physiology. It drives behavior. Damasio's idea that feelings are basically perceptions of our body state, motivating us to seek balance.
Okay. From the brainstem foundation to the chemical messengers, hormones and neurotransmitters.
All right, another level of understanding brain function, the chemical signaling.
Well, global, slower, affect gene expression, metabolism, neurotransmitters, local, fast, synaptic, change ion flow, excitability.
That's the main distinction. Though there's overlap, some hormones act as neuromodulators, tweaking neuronal communication.
Yeah.
And we have receptors for both all over the brain. Lots of messengers, maybe 30 neurotransmitters, many more neuromodulators.
And the hypothalamus is key for coordinating these hormonal and neural systems.
Mm-hmm.
Metabolism, hunger, sleep, temp, sex drive, social stuff like the HPA stress axis.
Absolutely. It's the master regulator, linking the nervous system to the endocrine system. The HPA axis is a classic example. Stress triggers hormonal cascades affecting mood and health.
Both made from simple precursors. Adrenal hormones, cortisol, adrenaline, noradrenaline, dopamine effect arousal, heart rate, glucose, mood.
Yep, the core stress response hormones. Mobilize energy, increase alertness. Big impact on brain and body.
Dopamine seems to do a lot. Movement, Parkinson's link, emotion reward, limbic system, nucleus accumbens, hormone regulation, hypothalamus, pleasure addiction. Andrew Huberman's work on focus.
It's incredibly versatile. Motor control, motivation, learning through reward prediction error. Focus. It's involved in so many circuits. Key nuclei releasing it include the substantia nigra and VTA.
Acetylcholine, big in the PNS, muscles, glands, heart rate, but also in the brain. Attention, learning, memory, sleep cycles, REM.
Crucial in both. In the brain, it's a major neuromodulator released from brainstem and basal forebrain areas, vital for cognitive function and sleep regulation.
An imbalance with dopamine linked to mental illness, and that link to the ancient four humors. Interesting historical echo.
Yeah, Bohr's theory about the balance, the four humors connection, maybe acetylcholine, dopamine, serotonin, noradrenaline, is speculative, of course, but shows a long history of trying to link biology and temperament. Even the Myers-Briggs link is tenuous, but reflects that impulse.
So we have these interacting systems, sympathetic adrenaline, dopamine versus parasympathetic acetylcholine.
Modulating brain activity, maintaining balance.
Personality, temperament, genetic, automatic reactions versus character. Learned conscious reactions. Cloninger's model, big five.
Modern theories try to map personality traits onto biological systems. Temperament is the foundation. Character is built upon it. Assessing leaders often boils down to basic perceptions of energy and trustworthiness.
Mental health is a delicate balance. Changes in chemistry affect personality. but avoid oversimplification. Psychoanalysis lacks verifiability, though therapy works via neuroplasticity.
Exactly. Neurotransmitter levels matter, but they don't explain how behavior is controlled. We need models of information flow. Therapy likely works by rewiring circuits through emotional engagement and learning, regardless of the specific theory's testability.
Serotonin, 5-HT, from RAF nuclei, locus coeruleus, affects sleep, mood, appetite, vomiting, sex drive, links to depression, migraines, anxiety, activated by immediate rewards.
Another key player, especially in mood regulation and well-being, widespread influence.
Noradrenaline, norepinephrine, from locus coeruleus, brain arousal, some autonomic functions, anxiety stress link, dopamine release, intermittent fasting effect.
Central for alertness, attention, stress response. Interacts closely with dopamine.
Severe stress disrupts the locus coeruleus, PTSD link. Medications target it. Involved in Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, REM sleep.
Yes, it's highly sensitive to stress. Dysfunction is implicated in many disorders.
So brainstem nuclei, global impact via widespread release. Local synthesis, fine-tuning specific networks.
That sums it up well. Global modulation and local control.
Okay, the reticular formation, RF. Diffuse network in the brainstem, ascending and descending paths. Lots of nuclei, many functions unknown. Brainstem, still mysterious.
It is complex. The RF is a core part, but yeah, lots we still don't know about specific nuclei there.
But we do know it's crucial for consciousness, arousal, ascending part, alertness, fatigue. Descending part controls muscle tone, a motivational system linked to introversion, extroversion, arousal levels.
All true. It sets the brain's overall activity level, essential for wakefulness, modulates motor output. The personality link suggests baseline differences in its excitability.
Damage leads to coma or persistent vegetative state, PVSUWS, also implicated in chronic fatigue, some ADHD.
Severe damage, yes. Coma is unresponsiveness. PVSUWS is wakefulness without awareness. The links to other conditions suggest RF dysfunction might play a role there too.
So coma, maybe brain death, irreversible cessation, no breathing, or vegetative state, brainstem functions, sleep-wake cycles, no awareness. PVS after 4 weeks, sometimes random motor cortex activity, but no higher processing. Rare recovery possible.
That's the grim progression. Brain death is final. VS is loss of cortical function but preserved brainstem. Occasional movements are reflexive, not purposeful. Recovery from true VS is extremely rare.
Minimally conscious state, MCS, is different. Some inconsistent awareness. Recognized later than VS. Terry Wallace recovered after 19 years. Terry Schiavo case, different. VS, severe atrophy.
Yes, MCS acknowledges minimal but definite signs of awareness. Wallace's case is remarkable, but Schiavo's situation involved far more extensive, irreversible damage. Differentiating VS and MCS is clinically important but challenging.
Akinetic mutism, intermediate state, damage to RF, thalamus, cingulate cortex, immobile, mute, but awake-looking, eye-tracking, no recognition. Cingulate damage causes apathy, pain, and sensitivity.
Right, a profound lack of motivation and initiation. They appear awake but are unresponsive volitionally. The cingulate's role in motivation and emotion is clear here.
Brain metabolism scans show the difference clearly.
Yes, PET scans show dramatically reduced glucose uptake in VS and coma compared to MCS or normal consciousness.
Locked-in syndrome, ventral pons damage, total paralysis except eyes, usually vertical blinking, but fully conscious. Neuroimaging helps differentiate the diving bell and the butterfly.
A terrifying condition. Consciousness trapped inside a paralyzed body. Neuroimaging is crucial for diagnosis, showing cognitive responses despite the lack of movement. Bobby's book is incredibly powerful.
So the brainstem is vital for consciousness itself. Damasio's core consciousness body loop idea
emphasizes the brainstem integrating body signals to create that fundamental sense of being.
Midbrain parts, tectum reflexes, tegmentum, moving control, substantia nigra, red nucleus, periaqueductal gray, PAID, for coordinating emotional reactions.
Key structures. PAID connects emotional states to bodily responses via the reticular formation.
So overall brainstem function, manage body states, represent them in somatosensory cortex. Modeling it is hard. Early ideas of modularity haven't advanced much. Rat brain database helps for specific bits. Wim Hof shows some conscious control is possible.
It's incredibly complex, making modeling difficult. Progress is slow. Wim Hof's abilities are intriguing, suggesting potential for conscious modulation of these deep systems, though the mechanisms aren't fully clear.
Okay, final big topic, the three brains in one idea. Evolutionary layers. Ettinger noticed hind midbrain similarity across vertebrates, but forebrain changes a lot. Neocortex, 6 layers, versus paleocortex, 3 layers.
Ettinger's comparative work laid the groundwork, seeing how older structures are conserved while newer ones, like the neocortex in mammals, expanded and differentiated.
Then MacLean's triune brain theory in the 50s. Still popular, even if simplified. Reptilian complex, instincts, limbic system, emotions, neocortex, rational thought.
Yes, MacLean's functional model based on Ettinger's anatomy. It's catchy and intuitively appealing, which explains its persistence.
Reptilian complex, brainstem, basal ganglia, midbrain. Regulation, reproduction, territory, aggression, ritual, hierarchy.
That's the core idea, basic survival and social dominance behaviors.
Limbic system, paleocortex, hippocampus, amygdala, hypothalamus. Emotions, defense, seeking food mates, caregiving, memory, episodic spatial. Fear, aggression, sexuality, hormones, stress, pleasure. Oxytocin, serotonin, cooperation for well-being.
The mammalian brain edition. Focus on emotions, attachment, social bonds, learning, and memory related to emotional events. The neurochemistry fits here too.
Neocortex, newest layer. Sensory analysis, cognition, problem solving, social behavior, language, culture, damage, cognitive deficits versus limbic damage, altered instincts. But emotion and reason are inseparable. Psychoneuroimmunology links mind, brain, immune system via limbic system.
The human or primate brain enabling higher cognition. But importantly, it works with the other layers. Reason isn't separate from emotion. Psychoneuroimmunology really highlights these deep mind-body connections, often mediated by limbic structures.
So our complex, ritualistic, limbic, emotional, neocortex, rational. Behavior is an integrated result. Damage effects vary by level.
That's the simplified summary. In reality, it's a constant interplay. Damage effects reflect the functions primarily associated with that level, but the whole system is affected.
Language evolution from gesture sounds. Limbic brainstem stimulation. Species-specific calls. Larynx-handedness link.
Hints at the deep evolutionary roots of communication, building on older systems.
Connections to Maslow's hierarchy. Our complex, survival, limbic, social esteem, neocortex, self-actualization, Plato's chariot, Freud's idigo superego.
People love drawing these parallels. The triune model offers a simple framework that seems to map onto these other psychological or philosophical models.
Challenges the noble savage idea. Chimpanzee aggression. Aggression as eye dominance, weak cortical control. Psychopathy as lack of integration.
Right. Suggests aggression has deep roots. Psychopathy could be seen as a failure of the higher levels to effectively modulate the lower ones, leading to our complex dominance, perhaps.
Freud's unconscious automatic processes may be hemispheric differences, not just hidden desires.
Modern view sees the unconscious less as a Freudian repository, and more is the vast realm of automatic implicit processing, potentially involving hemispheric specialization.
Criticisms. It's an oversimplification. Limbic system evolved too. Whole brain evolves together. Cortex influences subcortex. Strict separation is wrong. Don't assume damage location, sole function location.
All very important caveats. The brain is far more interconnected and dynamically interactive than the simple layered model suggests. It's a useful heuristic, but scientifically outdated in its strict form.
Why keep the reptilian parts? Still vital for survival. Newer structures mediate compromise between self-interest and cooperation. Evolution tinkers, doesn't perfect. Neocortex evolved from older cortex.
Exactly. Those functions are still essential. Evolution built upon, refined, and modulated those older systems rather than replacing them.
More criticisms. Bird intelligence despite different structures. Genetic similarities between reptile pallium and mammal cortex hippocampus amygdala. Evolution refines, not reinvents. Warning against pseudoscientific applications. For example, structogram.
Yes, bird brains show different evolutionary paths to intelligence. Genetic evidence points to deeper homologies than MacLean thought. And yes, beware of simplistic deterministic applications of the model in things like personality training.
Final point, brain diversity and convergent evolution. Insect, crustacean, reptile, bird, cephalopod, mammal brains look different.
Hugely different architectures.
But functional similarities, similar neuron mechanisms, even simple brains, complex behavior, cephalopod intelligence despite alien architecture.
Absolutely. Bayes' general principles are conserved. Complex behaviors can arise from seemingly simple brains. And cephalopods are a stunning example of convergent evolution, achieving high intelligence through a completely different neural design, likely driven by similar environmental pressures.
So The learner, wrapping up this deep dive, wow, we covered a lot. Evolution, structure, chemistry, consciousness, models like the triune brain.
Hopefully it provides that solid foundation you need for CogSci 101, seeing how structure, function, and evolution are all intertwined.
We aimed for that framework, connecting the levels, highlighting key concepts. Hopefully it helps as you continue your studies.
Remember the key takeaways, the dynamic nature of the brain, neuroplasticity, the importance of interconnected networks, the evolutionary layering, the chemical signaling.
And here's a final thought to chew on. We talked about the brain's unique architecture and these new neuromorphic computers trying to mimic it. As we get better at understanding both biological and artificial systems, what might be the biggest implications for how we define intelligence itself? What changes when the line gets blurrier?
That's a great question to carry forward. The intersection of neuroscience and AI is raising profound questions about the nature of mind and intelligence. Keep asking those questions. Thanks for diving deep with us.
If